Hey there, and welcome to another episode of the We Move podcast. There are a couple of questions that Chris and I are often asking ourselves, and they're questions that arise from the conversations that we're having with our guests. So these are, why do we do this stuff? What is it about us as humans that want to see what's beyond the physical and metaphorical mountains or obstacles that are in front of us, and how do we get meaning from doing what we do? Like, why are we doing it? Why do we practice yoga? Why are we choosing to go running or climbing? And also, why are emotions so important to the whole performance, growth and progression of our lives and our practices? There have been many times when you just don't feel great, and the performance has a similar direction. But then you feel great, and performance just goes through the roof. So what is it about emotion? Like, and how can you recognize the emotion and move them on? And it's something that when we meet characters who've achieved great things, or are operating in a zone of their potential, we notice there's this real feeling of connectedness within them. It's like the dots have lined up and they're able to connect all the dots, and in the moment they can navigate scenarios, be that in sport, in business or in life, whatever their skill is, they can navigate them with a seeming ease. And this isn't to say that what they do is easy, but for them, this culmination of practice of many different facets and a real understanding of who they are as people, they become comfortable in situations that others might not be. They're not reckless, they're not dangerous, although that may seem so to people looking in, but they are able to be present, connected and whole. It goes and connects in with this idea of flow state, etc. But I think more importantly, it's like they have an integrated practice with the theory, to the point where in the moment they can literally create more time to perform and deliver the performance and the result that they want to deliver. And it's this concept of integration that is really coming into more and more of our conversations and experiences, particularly now, but they have been for the last 6 months. And in the last 6 months, we have been developing the CHE program. So integration is at the very core of CHE, and it's with this concept. It feels right to talk to experts and really get into the way people think, what goes on in the body when we experience life, and how we can, with skills and tools, how we can course correct limiting beliefs and blockages that hold us back and can hold us in states of anxiety, depression, fear, and really start to flip them around so we can trend upwards and do two things: strengthen our positives, but also lift the level going from a negative to a positive. So we start to just improve across the board and really become more rounded across the board. So the first expert we have is Damien Ferns, and that's today's podcast. Now, Damien is a trainer, a coach and a therapist. He specializes in a methodology called Integral, which for those of you who've heard of Ken Wilber, that's all linked in with him. And he's also a solutions focused psychotherapist. So he does two things there. And there are two reasons why we've got Damien on today. One of which is we've worked with him and had conversations with him about all these conversations that we've been having. And he's also on the co-creation team for CHE. Because it's been really important for us to create an environment that is connected like minds, because that's the way that we've that we believe and has been shown in over time to be where humans thrive, irrespective of their abilities or where they are on paper. But when people come together, great things happen. And can we give people the tools and support them in integrating those tools into where they are and who they are as individuals to become these more rounded, sort of well-formed experiences, which we're calling a complete human experience. So Damien, he's on the co-creation team with us, and his day job, so to speak, is working with a whole host of some of the biggest companies in the world, global blue chip clients, developing their teams as individuals and also to come together as groups to become more well-rounded, more well-connected in their ability to communicate and work with people who we're all different, you know? So it just seems a really poignant time to do this. So we talk about how we get the best out of ourselves, how emotions are stored in the body, and how experiences that we have that could be seen in the moment to be traumatic can leave us with an imprint within our body. And this could be an imprint of fear or anxiety, etc., that can really hold us back many years on unless they're recognized, sort of brought to the surface and skillfully supported to be removed. So this is a great listen. It comes without the heavy jargon. It's why we really enjoy talking with Damien and listening to what he has to say, because heavy jargon can often come in with this world. And it's a great listen for anyone interested in attending the CHE. And there are a few podcasts that we would recommend kind of listening to for CHE and also to lead you on from here. And I recommend this podcast, of course, and The Rewire Project with Tony Molina, because Tony is also on the co-creation team for CHE. This week's Thoughts On, which is with Damien, but talks specifically about the CHE assessment process, why we're doing it, why it's important to have this, and how to approach it for the best results. Not necessarily the best results for CHE, but the best results for you or one when they're completing it and filling it out, because there's a lot of great stuff that can be gleaned and gained from there. So enjoy, and as always, let us know what you think in Instagram comments or YouTube comments or emailing us. And for more information on CHE, hit the link in our Instagram bio or visit our website wemove.world or wemovemagazine.com and click the banner on the homepage. Enjoy Mr. Damien Ferns. Welcome, Damien Ferns, to the We Move podcast.
Hello.
Hello. You are a trainer, coach, and therapist.
That's right.
And you are one part of the Complete Human Experience team now.
Yep.
And that's how we...
I've not had the initiation yet.
Well, this is the initiation. This is the formal initiation.
Okay, right. Should I be naked for this? Or
we do the naked afterwards. Because we have to wait till Esky's awake to do the screaming.
Okay.
The naked screaming.
Naked screaming.
In front of the school, it always goes down well. So we met in a hub, one of Brighton's hubs for, I'm going to say, mental, spiritual and physical coffee drinking.
Yeah.
Which is Stony Point.
Yeah.
And
emotional coffee drinking.
Emotional
well,
coffee
sometimes.
Drinking. And we got talking.
As initiation to walking through the door. You only come in if you're crying your eyes out.
Yeah, yeah. And we started having a conversation about kind of what we're doing. Usual coffee shop chit-chat. And then that led into quite a long time, because I remember getting nothing done and you were probably a similar thing, about the complete human experience and the goals of Chris and I to create an experience which supports people in transcending through the physical and really starting to unlock, I guess, keys to their performance for life, longevity and health and movement. And then we started linking in frameworks. And what was interesting to me were the four podcasts that we'd previously done, one of which was with Jamie Wheel of Flow Genome Project, who was management consultant using the framework of Ken Wilber's integral methodologies. And that's, you are an integral coach.
Yeah.
So, and this idea of integration, and Chris and I have started to discover more in conversations, this disconnect between people seeking these states, chasing states, doing these physical practices, yet not integrating them. So they start to just become, I'm going to say, vanity projects. It's the wrong phrase, but gives a kind of the right sentiment. It just becomes a means to an end, and they go and get in the ice, but they don't translate that into their life to improve their life. It's just they become crutches, and they don't really know why they're taking those crutches when they don't need
it. It becomes another way to achieve a sense of achievement, to get a sense of achievement in life, or a sense of status, or a sense of this kind of thing, achievement or status.
And that seems to be, and we'll go into what integral is and the other frameworks, it seems to be where people get stuck in that cycle but don't apply it to their life in the wider context, and then wonder why they just hit these plateaus or aren't really being fulfilled spiritually, mentally, physically, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
So that was kind of how we got talking, and then came together to co-create our first Complete Human Experience Symposium, which is sort of starting to support people in their own integration for the wider world, so they have themselves a set of tools and skills and also experiences to refer back to and apply forward. So that's how. That even sounds quite good to me. Maybe it's but that's how we got talking. Then I left the coffee shop and I was like, called Chris, and I was like, dude, we need to do this in a bigger way. And that's why CHE is so exciting, and I find our conversations are exciting. And then inadvertently you two met without realizing, and then the triangle's complete.
In the in-between space, we met very briefly, not knowing that you knew James.
Jess is the pivot point, huh?
Yeah.
Jess, who owns Stony Point, that is.
Yeah.
So, integral or integration, why is it so important? Can I ask you that in such a... Well, I can ask. I have asked you that.
You have asked me that question. Well, the integral approaches to development are sort of pioneered by this woman called Claire Graves and Robert Keegan and Ken Wilber. These are all sort of people who've looked at the development of the human being from birth through to death, really. And the integral part of it really is pertaining to the idea, well, it's really looking at holism as well, the idea that everything is a part of something else. So us as a human being, we are part of our environment. The earth is part of the cosmos, etc., in the physical realm, but also consciousness is involved in that. So the ancient Greeks used to use the word cosmos, and it had a K in the beginning of it, but it was to describe everything that existed, not just physical matter, but our consciousness itself in relationship with physical matter, the whole thing. So integral really is saying that whenever we... Integral developmental theory is really saying that as we move through the stages of our development, which seem to be in more or less 7-year cycles as we go through our lives, that we are bringing in aspects of things that we learn from our physical environment, our external world, and we're also making sense of that in our internal world. And this relationship between the external world and the internal world actually develops our personality. We develop because of that constant interplay of our consciousness going out to the outside world saying, how is this out here meaningful and relevant to the way I am inside, to my own point of reference, my own inner templates? And it's that constant movement from the inner template to the outer world, which creates the sense of self. And that comes up from birth. And we can see that in babies.
I know you've got 7 years.
So you've got, so as a baby, you are, a baby, you are completely at one with your environment. The idea of external and internal doesn't really exist because it's all just one. Mm. And then there is an essential separation where you start to learn and your personality starts to develop because your consciousness is able to go internal and external. And that's happening very, very quickly all the time for all of us anyway, to some degree. That might be a bit of a... Is that a clear enough explanation or how can I...
Yeah, I think it is.
I've gone in deep straight away there, so yeah.
Well, jump in.
I've jumped straight in deep, yeah.
The integration is because we're going in and out of it, so say... First 7 years of a human's life, they're just in it. And then putting it into like movement or sport or practice. When you see people that are at the top of their game and they just, or they don't just, they seem to be fully immersed in it.
Yeah.
And then there are people that are aspiring. Are they jumping in? Are they just flicking in between the two? And is that first 7 years, it's presence and they're fully present. So
yeah, so but great to bring the movement into it because as you can see with the baby, there's not really much control over their limbs or their facial muscles or anything that's going on, but there is the beginning of trying to do that from birth, you know. Mm. there's the beginning of trying to mirror your environment from birth. So as soon as a baby's born, it has the ability, even though it has blurred vision, as soon as it's born, to seek out a human face in the environment and to attempt to make a facial expression to copy the facial expression which is in front of them. So this is the first time where the external world is being mirrored by the internal. That information is being taken in through the senses, and there's a genetic template already set up in the human being there to try to mirror their environment and to build rapport and connection with the environment. And the way we build rapport is by mirroring each other and connecting in with each other. And this is something which is essential to the human being all the way through life. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to live in communities and do all the amazing things that we do. Mm. Because we work in groups. And that happens with a baby right at the beginning. So even though the baby doesn't know that it's got a face, should we say, even though the baby doesn't know that it's got muscles that can move in this way and that way, there are electrical impulses being sent to try to get the muscles to move. Even though the baby doesn't know what a smile is, you know, all these other things that we have, that which we develop later on to put names and labels on things and try to make sense of them in the outside world, there is this intrinsic and innate ability to try to mirror the environment. That continues throughout life. We build our personality in many ways because we are mirroring what we experience through our developmental period. And we hang that on us in one way or another to make our own personality, and we interact with the environment in that way. And also with to bring it back into movement even more so, you can see, I mean, you have a seven-month-old now. So you'll see over time, like you said, the first 7 years of this sort of arriving, almost like arriving in the body.
Mm.
And then being able to use the body. And that's carrying on going, you know, that arriving into the body and becoming used to having this as your home and the way that you can move inside of it is really an ongoing natural development that I don't think is really complete until you're more towards your sort of 21-year-old, somewhere between 14 and 21, really. It's still going on where you're really arriving in your body.
So kind of three cycles in and then you're in your body.
Yeah.
And is that like full development?
No. So yeah, good point as well, because you know, for many, many years within psychology and within the medical profession, you had a very strong belief that the human being, in terms of brain development, in terms of how our personality develops even, very, very strong belief held across the medical establishment that once you were 21, your brain was done, and that was you, and you were going to remain that way for the rest of your life. And so your brain started to deteriorate sometime after 40, and then definitely increasing deterioration as you got older.
Is that why people think of 18, 21 as being adulthood?
Yes, yeah, exactly. And again, what we've understood in the last sort of 10, 15 years of brain science is that that is just completely not true. The brain is making new neural connections, new neural networks, and has the ability to do so all the way through to death. It still has the ability to learn. So the brain is a learning organ in many ways. That's what it's there for. And its main way of learning, to bring it back to the idea of the internal and external pulsing, its main way of learning is through metaphor. So we have this brain is a metaphorical pattern matching organ. That's one of its functions. It has the ability to say how is out there like something I've already experienced. And then each of those pieces of learning, if you like, gets laid down sleep after sleep, day after day, until we build up a kind of network of learning, a whole set of neural networks that are all to do with metaphor and association. Mm. And, you know.
So could it be said then, you're learning by proxy, so you're learning all these stories throughout your entire life until the moment that you realise that you've been learning by proxy. And that's when you kind of then start to really learn, because you start to consciously choose what it is that you want to learn rather than having it forced upon you.
Yeah, well, that is definitely, you might say that we don't always get to choose what our early development is like. We rely very much on our parents and our community and our family and friends for our early development. But then we start to develop the ability to choose for ourselves, yeah. And some people seem to have a greater ease in choosing, having a sense of free will, perhaps, than others. And we can see that when we look around in our lives, in our society, we can see that there are people who feel like their life has been chosen for them and they can't break out of whatever cycle or position they find themselves in life. And there are people who feel like it is their kind of right and their sort of given nature as a human being to be choosing their own destiny from day to day, and then there's lots in between. Yeah.
But even so, I guess what actually I meant maybe was we don't realise that we're governed by stories. Mm. Lots of people don't realise that they're governed by stories.
Yeah.
If you're lucky, you do.
Yeah.
Because then you can do something about it, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And so I suppose that's what I mean in terms of, you know, you go through your life governed by these stories that you have no idea about. Until that moment where you start to become conscious of those stories or of those traumas, and then you start to actually almost feel like it's like a bell curve. You start at the bottom at zero, and you go up until you get to a point where you then start to try and get back down the other side to zero, where you're completely pure again of all the shit that you didn't want to actually acquire, but you were put in the situation where you did.
I think it's a really good point. And just last week I was had a client for therapy, and he was recounting stories to me of someone that had meant a lot to him in his youth, so when he was about 14 years old. And he'd noticed that he'd been saying the catchphrases and maxims of this particular character as though he'd really bought into them and wanted to live his life by them. And in some ways, he was also living his life and taking these sort of catchphrases and almost slogans of ways to live. And he'd come to a realization now, and he's in his 50s, that a lot of that stuff has not served him in any way that's been good and has actually led to many problems in his life. And it took him a while to sort of wake up to that and realize that some of these ideas and some of this person that he admired at this age, for various reasons, had some qualities that were obviously admirable, and then some qualities that upon reflection in his 50s, he realises he wish he hadn't really taken those on as a way to be, or something to replicate, or something to strive for, you know. So these stories that we pick up are not just explicit stories, but they can kind of be quite implicit in our lives from just the general contacts that we have in our everyday life with people that we meet that we admire or are impressed by in one way or another. And there could be people that are in our everyday lives, or people that we also hear about in stories, or even celebrity, or, you know, people that you think, wow, this guy's amazing, I want to be more like him. That kind of aspect of things, yeah. So
in issue 2, we wrote about progress is only
has to be made through a process of unlearning, like recognizing those stories, then a process of unlearning them. But how do you unlearn? Because you can use kind of willpower.
Can I just precede that question? Yep. Can I can't see how you can. Can someone exist that doesn't go through that process? I mean, that's, you know, the process of unconsciously having stories. I mean, that there isn't any individual in the world, surely, that unless you live in isolation, like that's going to happen to you, right?
It happens all the time.
To everyone, I mean.
In some ways, we could say it's a kind of a given of part of being a human being, really, is that this is the way that we work. And I guess that what we manage to do from that is that we manage to share. There's so much good things that can come, so many good things that can come from that. Because ultimately, we're sharing knowledge there. We're sharing ways of being in that process. And we can have a sense of choice around it. I mean, I don't know about you, but between 14 and 21, for me, there were some really big decisions that I felt I made at that age around how it was that I wanted to be in life or who it was that I wanted to be. And very much up until about 14, I probably was more in that realm that you were talking about, Chris, where you're moving from one to the other, being affected by them, and it's kind of chosen for you. And then somewhere between 14 and 21, your teenage years, you start saying, I don't want that, and I don't want that, but I do want this, and I do want to be more like that, and I do want... And I think it's an essential part of us sort of striving to become the best that we can be in whichever way that shows itself to us.
Sorry, James.
No, that's fine. So you recognise that you have these things that don't serve you.
Mm.
How does someone go about unlearning them? Because you have to unlearn them.
Yeah.
Because they're in, and you're doing it. They're automatic, aren't they? At that point, they're kind of in, and you don't really realise.
Yeah.
And probably for both of us, we got to that at about 33. So interesting, like.
The beginning point. Still working on that.
Yeah, absolutely. But kind of four cycles in. You're four and a half cycles in.
The initial moment where you kind of realise that, oh, hold on, I'm maybe playing out something that's not actually mine. Yeah, around about early 30s. Yeah.
After 21 to 28 plus, you're kind of in it, aren't you? And that's the... You're doing things that you think you should do. I should do it like this because I should be like my... dad who did this, and this is the way to be, and then you realize that you're kind of unhappy because you're actually not living like your dad. You're living like you saw what I was living like. I saw my dad living.
Yeah.
Missed the metaphors.
Yeah.
Of what he was.
It was
doing.
Like a natural mirroring of it in a way. Yeah.
And then that process of unlearning, and I believe that everyone goes through that and doesn't necessarily realize it. Most people perhaps get it too late.
Yeah.
When there's so much society and culturing there, there's, you know, the relationship they're not really happy with, the children that they've had with the partner it wasn't serving them, and the mortgage and their job.
I don't think you should
be
allowed to get married until you're way into your 30s.
Because I
changed the law.
I mean, I jest, but it's like, how do you even know yourself until you're into your 30s, i.e., you know, you've gone through all that stuff that you realize is not yours. And actually, you know, I was joking with someone the other day. It's kind of like, I kind of smile at who I was when I was in my teenage years. Mm-hmm. Radically different to who I am now. You know, I'm grateful for who I am now. Mm. I just imagine if I would have got married. I mean, it's probably why I've had a few long-term relationships. And, you know, they've all served a purpose for both of us. But, you know, it's allowed me to kind of realize who I am. And now kind of, you know, having a bit more awareness of that, being in my late 30s, now I could consider, you know, that maybe it would be a good idea to commit my life to someone as opposed to being 22 and committing to your life, which is not to say that true love doesn't exist, but it seems almost preposterous to jump into that at that age.
Yeah.
So how does someone go about unlearning? That's, I guess, why you're doing what you're doing.
Yeah.
But what are the steps for people? How would you guide someone through? Or maybe you don't really guide, you just point a finger for them to discover.
There is a distinct process, and the process is, first of all, to build awareness around what those things are, so you know what they are, to start to knock out some of the positive expectations that you have attributed to those particular ideas or beliefs or ways of being that you've taken on. You know, the slogans, the catchphrases, the maxims which are running in the background and saying, you know, prioritizing your behavior and how you should act in a particular situation. So you knock out some of the positive expectations around that. You noticed how some of those ways of being have brought you things which have not been so good in your life, and which may have hindered your development or hindered your growth because you've been stuck in this particular box that you've put yourself in, this way of being. And then to start to sort of revamp, if you like, your life by building sets of positive expectation around new ways of being, and then sitting with somebody, we would work out what are those new ways of being, and what do we want those new ways of being to really achieve further down the line. And then so very much when we look at anything that's to do with behavior change or even the way we perceive ourselves or change perception, a lot of it is to do with repetition of something. Sometimes you can create change because there's a really big emotional upheaval and, you know, almost like an awakening kind of change. Mm-hmm. But very often it's a bit more boring than that. Very often it's about observing yourself, seeing when you're being in the old way, noticing it, pulling back from going too far into it, looking at what you want to achieve by being in the new way, and looking at what it is that you've concretely laid out as ways to practice being in the new way, and try and stick to those, and repeat until your expectations manifest, until what you've set out as your kind of goals and what you want to achieve starts to manifest. And it may manifest in ways that you didn't necessarily expect, and that can be the more exciting, fun aspect of it all. But that's more or less what we're looking at, and that's really to realize that, you know, much of what all of us are doing all the time is trying to fulfill our own expectations that we carry with us into the world. Our expectations being a combination of our ability to imagine the future and our ability to emotionally engage with it in a way where we're trying to meet a need or get something done. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. And the emotional... Yeah.
Sounds exciting, actually.
Yeah. Yeah, the emotional engagement, that's the part... Well, I guess both of the parts, but that's really affected by your past.
Yeah.
Then, and the stories come through.
Yeah.
How do you apply the metaphors? Because we spoke about metaphors, particularly the ice bath.
Yeah.
As, you know, how that becomes a metaphor for fear or growth or whatever. Yeah. How do people use those metaphors? Because everything's a metaphor.
Yeah.
If you can sort of be in a position to see it, like those funny pictures.
That yeah.
You know, you have to look past the picture to see what's in it.
Yeah.
How do people look past the metaphor to see what's in it to then apply?
Yeah.
Because it feels like that's where lots of people get lost, particularly in movement. So today we were talking about my belief that the major sports, or why people play sport, move, etc., is there's a deep intrinsic need for the body to express something, an emotion that's been held in there, and it's crying out to be released. So people are drawn to doing a physical practice. That was underpinned with Tony Molina talking about the cycle, the trauma cycle, that in the way, way back, Tony Molina is one of the co-creators of CHE, so he's the Special Forces guy. He was saying that fight or flight, before it was, there were two outcomes. You'd either be eaten by the lion or you'd escape the lion. If you were eaten by the lion, it doesn't matter because you've been eaten by the lion. But if you escape, and you'd have probably, and animals do in the wild, they shake out, but humans don't shake, so they don't release that emotion.
Yeah.
But the body says we must go back into that place.
Yeah.
So you get people addicted to running and they're never, or whatever practice it is, but they're never releasing it because they almost layer on the trauma, that emotion, and they get further and further away from it. But the body's going, they're trying to return home and they're never allowed.
Yeah.
So they keep running back in and locked in this cycle. And I've lost the point of why I was talking about that.
I'm talking about the trauma cycle.
Kind of, how do people use those metaphors? Like, why are you running?
Yeah. Well, I think that kind of metaphor or analogy of how, I think it might even be a really genuine thing, really, like we look at the animal kingdom and you shake out after you've had a trauma. I think these are really part of our biopsychological aspects and how they, you know, the body mind connection. I think they're the same thing in many ways. Mm-hmm. You know, if for an animal, for instance, they can shake out some sort of trauma, but they can learn quite quickly through a conditioning process to not go down that particular path anymore, or to avoid the water or whatever it is that happened to them that caused them to have that. And so they don't hold the trauma in their body. They learn from it, and then they move on and change their behavior quite quickly through a conditioning sort of process. And we're also susceptible to that conditioning process. But because we have the ability to think into the future and worry about the future, and we also have the ability to think into the past via our imagination and think about what happened to us in the past, then we have that gives us another thing to worry about. Because now we're not just worried about what's happening in the given moment, which is how an animal would work. Mm. We're actually saying, but what if? Well, I'll never do anything like that again, because what if this happens or what if that happens? And so we worry. And this worrying itself uses up a lot of glucose, uses up a lot of attention, which we could be spending on solving the problems. So the more energy and attention we spend on worrying, the less energy and attention we spend on solving the actual issue or the problem that's in front of us. And that can compound trauma. The more you focus your attention on the thing that happened, and the more you worry about it happening again, then the more that gets laid down in the brain, because our emotional part of our brain, our limbic system, has no ability to differentiate between what is in the imagination and what is in reality.
How do you break that then?
Yeah.
Because, you know, that becomes the, I'm not leaving my bedroom, it's dark, you know, it's too scary, the anxiety is too much.
Yeah.
Like the spiral downwards.
The complete spiral downwards. That's exactly it. Yeah.
It becomes a bit like a helter-skelter, right? You get faster and faster. So is there a way? I mean, obviously there is. Yeah. How do you break that?
Yeah, and if you've got, you know, then that emotional imagination can even lock the condition responses in even more and develop the condition responses even more, and so you can get stuck in behaviors, you know, and that's why you get phobias. That's why you get people who don't walk outside of their house. And they, you know, they might have gone to a supermarket and had a terrible panic attack in the supermarket and thought they were having a heart attack. And so they come back home and they think, well, I won't go to the supermarket again. I'll take it easy and I'll just go to the shop. So they go to the shop and they have the same experience there. And then their brain goes, well, then it wasn't about the supermarket. It was about the shop. So they go, I'll tell you what, maybe it's about shopping. Mm. So I'll go out and I'll tentatively go out. But now they're worrying about going out, even just to the park, because the experience that has been so big, such a big emotional response, that now when they go to the park, they start to get an emotional response. Mm. And then they start to label it and say, well, it must be that every time I'm outside of the house, I'm getting this. So maybe I should just stay in. And so you get this building and this compounding of the experiences and the emotions which condition that process in. So that's what can happen there. So the person can even then the person can be sitting in the house thinking, oh, what would it be like if I go to the park? Oh, it'll be terrible. So like exactly what you're saying, Chris, you know, how do you break that? Because there's the downward spiral from the supermarket to the shop to the park to even sitting and imagining being in the park. And now you've created a downward spiral through your imagination and through your sense of expectation, which is incredibly powerful. It creates our reality for us in many ways. Breaking out of it requires you to be able to, first of all, lower the level of emotional arousal which is attached to those memories or those particular stimuli, shall we say.
And is the emotional arousal still limbic?
Yes.
So it doesn't know whether it's good emotion. It's just
exactly
emotional response.
Exactly. So good or bad. And the emotional mind, if you like, we associate it with the limbic system, but it's probably more appropriate scientifically to call it emotional mind, because there's lots of different parts of the brain that are involved. So for to make it more precise, let's say emotional mind. So the emotional mind doesn't have the ability to differentiate between reality and imagination. But therein can be the cause of the problem, but therein can also be the solution. Because if you can consciously and willfully, first of all, it's very important to lower the level of emotional arousal that's attached, and there's various trauma therapies that can do that. And there's also trainings to lower your emotional arousal. So we can lower our emotional arousal by down-regulating.
And the breath.
The breath. With long, slow out-breaths. And this can lower our emotional arousal quite effectively, by having a really long, slow out breath. It's something the brain tends to do when it's in slow wave sleep at night. So it tends to be in our most relaxed state, if you like. It tends to go into this kind of breathing pattern. This down regulation of breath, which I think you've spoken about on other podcasts things. Yeah, yeah. And then start to re-engage the imagination in different ways. But the key thing is that you're able to start to use your imagination creatively. We're getting around to it eventually. Yeah, it's about using your imagination creatively, and that might mean that you might need to go and see a therapist or somebody that can help you to use your imagination in a healing and creative manner, in order to get the brain to not remove the emotional tags, but reduce the level of emotional arousal that it is assigned to particular stimuli. So, and that can be done through various different forms of trauma therapy. Mm.
I'd never heard of the connection between the biological response and the glucose. So that layers in as well to the emotional. So there's like a physical, mental response.
Yeah. Completely, yeah. So would you like me to explain that?
Mm.
Yeah. So usually if you have this is called the mental health continuum is one of the sort of titles that it's got, and it's if you have an event that happens to you, say the death of a loved one or the loss of a relationship or something like that, that's really caused you a lot of anxiety. It's a big shift in your life, you're having big emotional responses, you're crying, you're worrying, you're tense, you're scared, you don't know what the future's gonna hold. You're trying to deal with the loss of this particular person in your life that was part of your support network. Now, your brain goes into a sort of heightened sense of worrying about that, a level of emotional arousal, should we say, that's present in the mind. And when we go to sleep at night, one of the functions of our dreaming is to try to metaphorically represent the problem to our brain in a way where we can get the resolution to the problem, where we get a sense of resolution. So the dreaming brain has this capacity to use metaphor as a way to present a problem, to find what the particular solution to it. Once the solution's found, we then should get a reduction in the amount of emotional arousal, and because of that, the amount of orientation, the attention that the brain's wanting to put on the thing. So when the person wakes up in the morning, if they've had a healing dream, which has managed to do that for them, then they wake up feeling fairly refreshed and able to deal with their day ahead, and their emotional arousal has dropped a little bit. Mm. And then the next day until the problem's resolved and they've got all of their capacity to be able to create changes and do what they want in their life. If that's a big thing that you're not getting resolution to in your everyday life, and you're worrying about it all day and you're focusing your attention on it, then when you go to sleep at night, your dreaming brain will keep on trying to present it to you. And as that happens, the length of time that we spend in REM dream sleep starts to increase. And the length of time that we spend in slow wave deep sleep starts to decrease. And that means that the brain doesn't get to refill with glucose, which it needs to do in slow wave sleep. Doesn't get to relax and rejuvenate, because when in REM sleep, you use up the same amount of glucose as if you were awake. And it also means that when you wake up in the morning, you're going to feel really exhausted. You've not got the resolution to your issue, but now you're increasing your level of exhaustion. And every single day, so in anxious people and people that are suffering with anxiety, we see that their REM length of sleep increases and increases. And if it carries on increasing, you've tried everything, and you tried to get a resolution, you tried to get back with your partner, you've tried to move beyond it, whatever it is in your everyday life, and you're not getting resolution in your waking state, and you're not getting resolution in your sleeping state, then eventually you learn helplessness, and this becomes depression. Depression is the lack of motivation to bother doing anything about it, because what's the point? I've tried everything, and it doesn't work. So this is depression. What's the point? Then you wake up in the morning feeling exhausted. You might even sleep during the day now and be awake at night because you'll have trouble there. And your sleep pattern starts to reverse. Then if depression, again, if you don't get resolution from that and that, or you don't get treatment, or you don't get either increase in exercise, medication, or therapy, which brings resolution. They're the three things which
they're the three things.
There are three things which cure depression.
The question that's coming is like, yeah. What do you do?
There are three things which cure depression: resolution to the issues, which you can get through therapy or through normal life; taking medication that has some ability to reinstate normal sleep patterns, which is often more of a sticking plaster than a solution; and increase exercise in order to get so exhausted that when you go to sleep, your brain has to go into slow wave sleep in order to repair the physical body, and so reduces the amount of REM sleep. And so when you wake up in the morning, you start to feel more refreshed, more able to start to work on your problem again in a way that might work. So this is the one little aspect there. To bring it back to the mental health continuum, anxiety, can't get resolution. Brain represents it metaphorically, can't get resolution, increases dream sleep. Wake up in the morning feeling exhausted. Eventually he goes into depression, learned helplessness, nothing I can do about it. Then you find that your sleep pattern gets really buggered up. Then if there's no resolution to that, people, even very healthy people, can end up what we consider maybe more emotionally healthy and resilient people, if they go through something like this, can end up in a state of psychosis. And the state of psychosis is when the brain is entering into the dream state to try to solve the problem, like it's trying to do all the time, which is what it's supposed to be doing, but whilst in the waking state. And so people have hallucinations, aural hallucinations or visual hallucinations, because the brain is actually projecting the dream reality upon the world, still trying to solve the problem, still trying to solve the issue, which they've not got resolution to.
So the body's really trying to get itself out of the for example, the hallucinations aren't actually the problem.
No.
The body's craving a solution.
Yes.
And really the solution is almost way more basic.
Very often it's way more basic.
I was going to say was, how do you work back through that? Perhaps you don't work back through that. You just go back to the beginning and get to there and the rest of it.
Well, you can work back through that, and one of the key aspects of that is really to there's a few different aspects to it, but the key one, first of all, is to try and reinstate normal sleep patterns. And there are various things that we mentioned about the exercise and the medication and the finding resolution. You can find some form of resolution through therapy, which most therapies are trying to help people come to resolutions through their problems in life in one way or another, as well as other things that they're doing. Then you know, anybody, or if you've ever had therapy, you've been through a problem like that, you've noticed that you might have had those therapy sessions where you feel like you've had a breakthrough. You've had a release, you've maybe cried a little bit, you've walked out of the therapist's room that day feeling slightly lighter than when you walked in. And you'll notice that night when you go to sleep, you have one of the better nights sleep that you've had for the whole time the problem was there. And this is a very common occurrence in therapy, is when the therapy's working, you usually start to sleep better. You usually start to feel better when you're walking out of the therapist's room. You start to notice, well, that was a good session of therapy. I actually feel slightly lighter, slightly better, slightly more hopeful. And also, particularly with depression, the idea that you are, because depression brings attention inwards, focuses attention inwards. With anybody that's depressed, one of the best things that you can do is try to get them to focus their attention externally and go and help other people, go and plug into the world in a way where they can feel like they're doing something good or they're doing something worthwhile. And that can really help somebody to start to, for depression to start to lift, because their focus of attention is not on their own problems. Mm. So it is basic. Some of it's to do with focus of attention.
Mm. The idea of being in service keeps coming up.
Yeah. I mean, obviously the joy of having these conversations in person is, having any conversation in person, is you start to relate it to your own thoughts, your own experiences with people, and you know, and things start to click into place, right?
Yeah,
like you hear things, you're like oh yeah, right, okay, now that I know that extra bit of information, that makes sense why that's happening, and that makes sense why that's happening. And I guess when I was like, my tendency is like, okay, I'm gonna go to the beginning and I'm gonna learn everything, and like, and so my question to you was like, okay, how do you, right, we're at the back, you know, we're at psychosis, how do we go back from psychosis to, you know, to dream, to anxiety, to
working all those through,
and actually it's like, well, you know, sleep,
yeah,
exercise,
yeah,
therapy,
yeah,
and we've been learning a whole realm of therapy treatments. I mean, yeah. I was in yesterday with a mobility guy, and just talking about the body storing trauma, you know, from, and just how doing these mobility exercises was giving the mobility back into the body, and how that was having this emotional release. And I was with someone the other day actually who had burnt her foot, and completely on a, by chance, there was a physio there, and she started to work on her foot just as a part of a group setting.
Right.
She wasn't there for a physio appointment. We just happened to be a physio and someone who'd got a burn on her foot, and she started to work on this burn on her foot, and she just started crying. You start to have this emotional release. And so I want to go to the how do we go back from psychosis? It's like, okay, there's actually some very straightforward things, and I think that's really hopeful.
Yeah, yeah.
It's not, you know, it's not so bleak that it's like, oh my God, I've got to now work my way through all these different things.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like there's some pretty fundamental basic things you can do, and I can't get out of my room, it's dark, I don't, you know, da-da-da, and it's like, okay, well, you know.
You can also see where technology really tricks the brain, because it brings you in, it keeps you awake, all of it,
yeah,
and
yeah,
that
yeah.
link with depression and anxiety,
yeah,
sort of how it, when you explain that it wasn't about technology, but you're like, oh wow, that can do that, because people, they're almost seeking external validation for but then it goes, it drops them back inside, because they're not,
well, it's
their yeah. imagination trips them up,
and yeah, so, yeah,
well, FOMO, I guess, it's like,
yeah. Yeah,
the fear of missing out, and it's just that perpetual cycle.
Yeah.
You stay up late, you're scrolling through your phone,
social media sort of stuff, and how we link into social media. Yeah.
How it, particularly now, seems to be that. And I wonder whether there's a correlation between that and this fitness boom that's happening. Again, the body crying out for, they're hooked on this, they're jumping to this, they're missing.
Yeah.
It's like, just stop that, go to sleep, you know, eat well. And it is...
completely
basic.
Yeah, no, go for it.
I was going to say it's
fundamentals. You know, the eating well, the going out and exercising, the being in service. Even I was just thinking, even having an animal that you've got to take out every day, it's like it's being in service.
Yeah. Mm.
But it takes you that out into nature.
Yeah.
Which gives you you're under the blue sky, so it gives you the oxytocin and serotonin release.
Yeah.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. And I think it's a, you know, there's lots of, I think one of the original conversations that we had was also around, we were looking at Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and, you know, Maslow being this humanistic psychologist who started to sort of realize that, and this very research-based conclusion was that when human beings have their basic physical needs and their emotional needs met, that they start to want to self-actualize. They start to want to reach to some of the highest sort of reaches of their potential, to become really great physically, really great emotionally, really great as whatever that they're doing to achieve their potential and become an individual, to become a true individual who kind of uncovers their own soul, should we say, this idea that you are becoming all that you are able to become in that way. And I think, you know, that bringing that back to the idea of integration and what that's about, that that actually there are probably a lot of people through the idea of social media, particularly because social media is very much around sense of status and sense of status that's recognised by others.
Yeah.
That, that that if we look at Maslow's need for status, it's an essential emotional need for the human being to have met. And it's to do with us being in tribes and how we were in tribes. We want to feel like we are a valid contributor to the tribe, and we want to feel like other people recognise that. So, and that makes us feel safe and secure. It makes us feel like we belong here. It links into all these other really, really, really important emotional needs of us. We can also end up with a greed for it. So if we feel like in our normal life, our need for status is not being met in one way or another, whether that's at work or whether that's within our family or whether that's within our friendship circles or anything else that we do, then we can end up with a, particularly as we grow and develop and go through our developmental stages, we can end up with a kind of greed for it in our later life. And that greed can be, first of all, the need can be used by other organisations to get us to buy things. That's one thing. And the greed can then drive you in ways which perhaps are not so healthy. Mm. So like a really great example of somebody who has a greed for status, I wish I wasn't bringing him into this thing, but you probably know who I'm going to say already, is Donald Trump. He's somebody who has a greed for status that is recognised by others. It's not enough for him. You know, self-esteem is a different need. Self-esteem is, I know I'm competent and I can achieve things, and I know that, and it feels good when I do it. I can brush up in here, and I can brush up really well, and I know I've done the corners. That feels great. I can feel self-esteem. Status that's recognised by others requires other people to be able to say, ah, Damien, oh, you're good at therapy, aren't you? Or you're a great singer, or oh, you're wonderful at making sweet love, or whatever it might be. But you know, but we all need that kind of status, and we get it in one way or another. But the greed for it can cause untold problems. It can put people into positions of extreme tyranny and authority. Mm. Can develop cult leaders. Can develop massive Instagram stars.
Yeah.
But you know, and you can see social media, like you said, it fools you. It fools you into thinking that, and it is meeting that need. I mean, I think we have to give it its due as well. To a degree, it does meet that need, but it meets it in a way that perhaps we've not quite adjusted to yet. Mm. In a way that's healthy.
Well, I feel it's there's a quest for self-actualization.
Yeah.
That overlooks the fundamentals, which almost seem as the basics that are so easy you don't need to do them and you can skip them out.
Yeah.
And just go straight to the top of the triangle.
Straight to the top of the triangle.
Whereas actually there's all of that underneath.
Yeah.
And if everyone had a solid base,
yeah,
that'd be a great place.
Yeah.
And we see that on social media. It's all about self actualizing.
Yeah.
And yet most of the people
self actualizing preaching.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah, the status to be seen as those cult leaders.
I have been on this weekend course. I have a certificate.
Yeah.
It is a qualification made up by someone who said that their name is a certificate.
Yeah.
Therefore, I can teach everyone.
Yeah.
But don't worry, it's okay. I haven't dealt with any of my fucking needs.
Yeah. Which is a status, and you create your own course to have status about what you've learnt to give validation to what you've learnt.
Yeah.
Yeah. And at the CHE, there will be no certificates. You will give yourself the certificate.
Yeah. And back to the CHE, maybe, and back to that, you know, we were looking at integration and the idea of going up through the stages and how and how it's important to do that, and how, you know, emotional needs are important within that process. I think it's the emotional thing that people really sometimes struggle with when they're trying to self-actualize and miss bits out. In my experience, it is anyway that it's for the majority of people, it's usually they're trying to meet an emotional need like status or self-esteem needs or the need to belong to a community.
Are they the historical pinch points for people? You know, that need to, the emotional trigger is caused by your mum not giving you sweets when you asked for them and you felt like you were not loved, and it comes back. They're
yes,
yeah. Past yeah. things that, yeah. that trigger this real
yeah.
Primal innate responsiveness. It's,
yeah, so if you so or,
which
or,
make them so hard for people to deal with because it's
yeah
it's
completely
something they can't vocalize.
Yeah. yeah, yeah, and some of those may be things around food and physical needs. We as a human being, as you know, we need to have the right nutrition to achieve our full physical strength and fitness. We need to have the right kind of sleep in the right order, the right times in order to do that. We need to have shelter above us. We need to be the right temperatures sometimes.
Yeah.
not all the time. 3 minutes.
Yeah. And we have a distinct set of emotional needs, which are status, belonging to community, competence and achievement, time to, I mean, we talked about this a little bit earlier, time to stop and think, time to be private and contemplate. Should we say like headspace? It's an essential emotional need, so we can engage this part of our brain. Need to give attention, need to give quality attention, need to receive quality attention. Again, these are essential needs. The need for safety and security, the need for us to be without undue or excessive fear, or consistent fear. So, you know, and we can look at our world and we can say, well, are these needs met by our world? And to what degree are they met by our world? If you sit and watch the news all day and you're scared about everything, you're scared about the extinction of all of the animals and the whole planet going, well, you are in a state of fear. And if you are in a state of fear all the time, then, yeah, we need to do something about that particular issue.
Yeah.
But you also need to realise that you being in a state of fear consistently is not going to help. Because you can't function properly if you're in a state of fear. You lose your ability to judge, to be able to see what's in front of you and make wise, intelligent decisions around what's in front of you, because you're being driven by your emotional brain, which is trying to meet the need for safety and security. So these are some of the things, back to the survival aspects of things, yeah. and back to what's going on when we look at the CHE, the complete human experience. And the idea is, you know, putting people into positions and people experiencing extreme cold or extreme heat or other extreme experiences.
Yeah.
So the emotional brain is going to go into a state of, well, I need to survive here. I need to meet this need for survival, safety, security, status, you know. Or, and you'll see status turn up when there's 9 people that want to do something and 1 person that doesn't. And they go, well, I'll lose face unless I do it as well. It'll come in there. You can see them all around you, these needs, active constantly in every human being, trying to be met in one way or another. So, yeah, I mean, this is a really important aspect of things, really, is to look at that. And there's various different... you can look at Maslow, you can look at self-determination theory, which is a big movement in America that looks at all these emotional needs and how they're impacting, how they create motivation, how they help people to create change in their lives. In the UK, there's a body called the Human Givens, who I did my psychotherapy training with. They're looking at the givens of human nature. What is it that we know biopsychosocially that we find it very difficult to argue against at the moment? And what is that knowledge and how does it fit together? How does the biology fit with the psychology, fit with the social science of what we know already from the past sort of 100 years of Western psychology and some ancient wisdom traditions thrown in there as well? But this is very well researched stuff. And like we said before, most people tend to struggle with understanding what emotions are, what they're there for, what is the function of them, and how do we become emotionally healthy. I remember listening to a radio show a little while ago, and there was some top psychologist, some clinical psychologist on there being interviewed, or psychiatrist, I can't remember, and he was going on about mental health for a while, and somebody said to him, I don't know whether it was the, I can't remember who it was, but somebody said to him, so could you tell me what the model of an emotionally healthy human being is, or a mentally healthy human being? And he couldn't answer the question.
Well, that was my question to him. Can you define being emotionally healthy?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I think that's like one of the really important things, which is for us to sort of focus our attention on as human beings, really, is to realize that we are emotional beings first before we are intellectual beings. And that's the way our brain works. You know, we take in, from the neuroscience of it, we take in information from our senses and we take in information from our imagination. It all gets flashed in the amygdala first, or all gets flashed to this lower parts of the brain to look at whether it's safe or not safe, but also to look at its emotional relevance. And then the brain will produce an emotion which it thinks is appropriate to this particular stimuli. And then when our conscious awareness comes online, very shortly afterwards, when we actually consciousness happens, every moment of our consciousness is already flavoured by an emotion that the brain's chosen for it. And that orients us to the world in different ways in order to get our emotional needs met. And an emotionally healthy human being is one who is able to plug into their environment by using their natural skills and abilities and resources as a human being, of which there are a distinct set, in a way which allows them to get in an environment which is not so toxic, hopefully a healthy environment, in a way which gets their needs met in that particular environment. And what we see when that happens, just like Maslow showed us from the research, is that you get this sense of resilience and well-being which arises in the human being, a greater ability to take the knocks of life, to take the crises and the traumas and the upsets of life, to still have to, you know, still be knocked by them, but to come round quicker, for it to not to become a long-term mental illness, should we say, and without the use of medication or anything else. If we have this emotional needs aspect met well, and people are using their skills and abilities well, such as their imagination and their ability to build rapport, those are some of the skills and abilities, then you've got a person who can start to self-actualize. Then you've got somebody who can then, you know, put their eyes higher to say, I want to be this in life and I want to do this, but doing it not from a place of necessarily mimicking or mirroring like we talked about when we first started the conversation, but doing it from a conscious place where they start to develop their individual self, or discover their soul, for want of a word, their kind of the seed that they've always been, you know, managing to become everything that it can because the environment is correct for it to do so.
Can you build resilient emotional health in an environment that is toxic?
We, all of us, have a sense of resilience to be able to do that because our environment is not always healthy. And we would learn in that we would end up developing our own skills and resources to a greater degree, should we say, if we're doing that healthily. So for instance, somebody who might have somebody might build their ability to form communities around them because when they grew up, for instance, they felt like they didn't have much community. Mm. And they've noticed that when they started to get some level of community, they started to feel better and healthier. And so they can start to, you know, want to build communities and be part of communities. And they might do that, for instance.
So you, because that sort of springs to mind the people people say that we are the product of the five people we spend the most time with.
Right. Yeah.
So you get some people that withdraw. And that's, in my head, that's still a toxic environment. Mm. By withdrawing, because you start to go into the darker bits and you create a vacuum. Tends to be the shit that goes into the vacuum as opposed to the good stuff. And then choose the people you're around carefully to give you a foundation to. Because if it's, what I'm hearing is, if we're mirroring and it's a projection of our internal is our external, you put the good people around you and they will, you know, hold you accountable, which is what we want. Almost the mind and body is trying to hold us accountable all the time. Then that starts to create an upward spiral.
You've worked it out, man.
Done.
I think so, I mean, there's an interesting moral and ethical question there, isn't there? I don't know whether you want to go into that on the podcast, but
why not? Well, you can start to control it so much, and I guess you become like a dictator of your own world, and you don't want to speak to anyone that doesn't.
Well, if we look at all the sort of the wisdom traditions of the world, they do differ in lots of ways. I remember talking to a Sikh once who told me that the way to happiness is to avoid people that are problems, and stay with people that seem to be, you know, more healthy and more happy. And I thought this was a very simplistic view of things, and I really liked him at the time, but I just thought, wow, well, just get rid of all the people who are
a problem,
who are a bit, who annoy me, or who get in the way, or who seem to be a problem. And I guess to my sort of Christian sensibilities, that sounded weird, because it was like the opposite of you know, the kind of Christian aspect or the Buddhist aspect of going and seeking out those that are the weakest in society, or the ones that are being suffering, the ones that are suffering in society, and spending your time with them, and or to be all the criminals, or the, you know, spending your time with them, so there's an interesting thing there, and I think there's an interesting difference between perhaps some Eastern and West. Well, not necessarily, because it exists in Buddhism as well, but Buddha would have said you need to, you know, look after the people that are suffering in your life as well, from what I understand of Buddhism. But
doesn't mean you have to hang out with them all the time.
Doesn't mean you have to hang out with them all the time, no.
But he did.
But he did, yeah. So there's this, and I wonder, you know.
As did all the avatars.
Yeah.
So the stories came down. That was it, right? They self-actualized. Yeah. They became enlightened to be able to.
Yeah, so the bodhisattva idea.
Yeah. To be able to, you know, hang out with the dudes and dudettes that needed, you know, the support and compassion.
I think that's exactly it, and I think that's an interesting thing. We're back to self-actualization. Is, well, what's the function of this self-actualization? Is it a completely selfish?
Right. What's the purpose?
Is it a completely selfish endeavor, or is it in order to be of service to others? You know, and that kind of does bring us round to one of the essential emotional needs is the need for meaning. And in the human being, there are sort of three essential ways in which the need for meaning arises in the human being. I don't know why, but I always use the word arising rather than met when I talk about this particular need, because it just seems more appropriate. And those ways are service to others. service to others. The dog's just been come for a cuddle. Service to others is one of them. Connection to something bigger than you is another one.
Which is the fundamental of any AA type program?
Any AA type program, any religious practice, any nature. You know, if you go into nature and you have those moments of oneness with nature, or any ideology or political movement, you are plugging into something which feels bigger than you, and you get a sense of meaning from being part of that bigger thing that you are part of progressing in one way or another. Mm. We could say that all of humanity is that. That all of us are actually a part of the progress of humanity, in some way as well. The other one is to bring it right back to why you should come on the Complete Human Experience. the other one is improving ourselves, development, stretching ourselves beyond where we were yesterday, so that every day we feel like we're becoming a new person, or at least becoming something bigger or deeper or more than we were yesterday. And the human beings tend to get the sense of meaning arising within them from all three of those things. I found it very difficult to try and think of any other way that we get it. It just seems to be absolutely spot on that when we look at understanding meaning, you know. We're reaching for that self-actualization. What are we really doing with that? Of course, we're developing ourselves. We're connecting to something bigger, because we're connected to everything that came before us and everything that will come afterwards. And we're serving. We can go then into a position of serving others.
There's no end point, though, to self-actualizing.
No, apparently not. So they say.
And that's where you go into. Yeah. Well, people always want an endpoint. It's like, oh, cool. When I'm in the top triangle, and I'm done.
I've done it.
So we can.
Yeah.
You know, whatever. But then you. Mode, so I can't help you with that at the moment. That was my phone. then you start. being in service to people, then you can go round. So you then on that, you're just on the path again, aren't you? And it's keeping yourself self-actualized.
Yeah.
So is it just an a positively unattainable top triangle?
Yeah.
There's always room for growth.
I think so. I think this is, back to the integral ideas that, I really like the works of Ken Wilber, and he's a great synthesizer, but I also like some of his little particular sentences or things that he said, it's turtles all the way down, like the idea that we're on the earth is on a turtle, it's turtles, it just goes on forever, So as far as we know, we are, from Wilber's point of view, we might be aware of the one or two levels of development which are kind of above us. We might have an awareness or an inkling of what some of the flavours and ideas are there, but we have no clue what's above that. And at some point in our evolution, we were at a point where we didn't understand the stage of consciousness that we're all at. If we won't go back so many thousands of years, then we might find that those people had an inkling of what we might become, but it wasn't really the same state of consciousness.
It's difficult to talk about. You get that even between generations, don't you?
You do,
like grandparents.
You do, yeah.
You know, how I will see the world compared to Esky, my son.
Yeah.
He'll be on a completely other planet.
Yeah.
And I'll be like, oh, why are you doing that? We used to speak into microphones.
In our day. Now it just gets picked up.
Telepathically.
Yeah.
Send the podcast out there telepathically. You can only listen to it if you're meant to listen to it.
it's down into the... It's not even thousands of years, that sort of shifts in consciousness.
There are some developmental theorists that say that everything is speeding up in terms of development, and actually most of our lots of different ideas on from different disciplines might say the same thing as well, with economics or they might say the same sort of thing, that actually everything's just getting quicker and quicker and developing faster and faster, and so we see more changes between generations than we would have done a couple of thousand years ago as well.
Even technology, technology is the classic example, right?
Yeah.
And yet the fundamentals are almost more important than ever when the speed of increases, or the speed of development increases.
Yeah.
Having those fundamentals solid is even more important, because you can do anything.
Yeah.
But without that,
I think this is it, and back to what it is to be a human being, which I think has always been the thing which has kind of driven me the most. I think the more we realise that we are emotional beings first, and we cater to that aspect of us first, then the easier the rest of our development and the rest of our evolution, either as a species or as an individual, will be. And if we have one of the things that really surprised me when I first studied psychology when I was 20, 21 years old was that I was reading about studies and reading books and reading lots of research, and the knowledge is as wide as it is deep. Psychology is a massive subject, really. I was reading all this stuff and thinking, well, why don't people know this in everyday life? What's actually happened is, in our modern world now compared to 20 odd years ago when I was doing that, is that people are more and more interested in those kind of things. People are more interested in psychology and self-development perhaps than ever before in recent times. That our wealth has given us the ability to do that, to self-actualize to some degree in that way. But I was really, really shocked at how there was so much knowledge that people didn't have about what human beings are like, and how we work. And I think there's that, again, to bring it back to that, to one of the, we can define human beings in lots of ways, but, we are trying to build ourselves from our environment, from the moment we're born, by plugging into it in the best way that we can, using our natural abilities and resources, getting that sustenance, those emotional needs from the environment, and building ourselves as healthily as we can from that sustenance.
Mm.
Our emotional environment is creates a nutrient for us to build ourselves psychologically. And if we don't get the right kind of nutrient, then we can end up with various different psychological issues or psychological problems. And some of those can be solved, not necessarily by going back and sorting the trauma out sometimes, but by just getting the person to help to start to create an environment where they do actually get their emotional needs met now, in the here and now. And that's what I think we've talked about this before, about people that have trauma therapy and come out of the trauma therapy and say, but my life's still the same. You know, the trauma was an aspect of maybe something that was blocking them getting their life right, but you've still got to do the work of building proper relationships around you and being as good a human being as you can be, and understanding yourself and knowing what you are and how you interact with the world. You've still got to do the work. It wasn't just the trauma that was holding you back. That might have been an important part of it, but it wasn't just that. It was, what are you going to do now, and how are you going to act, and how can you do that in the healthiest way possible?
Come to CHE and you can find out more. Well, it kind of feels like a great place to
to kind of wrap. We could continue to talk on it.
It felt a bit all over the place to me, because I was just allowed freestyle, and I went freestyle, and I haven't even been drinking anything or anything. I just went freestyle, so even I lost my threads a few times inside there.
Well, I think it's not a linear thing, is it?
No, that wasn't a linear thing to me, no, at all. It's my first podcast. Maybe I'll be more linear next time.
Yeah, and I think that's when people can understand it more, when it's not linear. Yeah. Because then it's like you can dip in and go, okay, yeah. Like I was saying to you earlier on, when I said, oh, yeah, my head's kind of like spinning into personal examples, and it's like you dip in and you're like, that's the bit that's relevant to me right now.
Yeah.
Yeah, or that bit's relevant to me right now. Or I can see that's where I was, or that's so on and so forth.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so kind of... It wasn't supposed to be the be all and end all of this is everything you need to know on this podcast.
Yeah.
Hour and 19 minutes.
I tried my best with that. Yeah.
and it was pretty good. I always see these podcasts increasingly more so as they're like pointing fingers into the, and you see the, wherever you are on the journey, you see the finger just pointing.
It's doing the work. There.
Yeah.
Here's a point for you to kind of pivot from, like, okay, now here's something. So if you didn't know before, now you have the availability of it, and now you can go away and investigate yourself. Because then when you do that, you get a wealth more, experience out of it. So.
Yeah, thanks, Damien.
Yeah, thank you very much.
Thanks. So thanks. For those who are interested further, register for the Complete Human Experience on our website. So that's wemove.world or wemovemagazine.com, or click the link in our bio on our Instagram. Fill out the form, and then we can start the process of sending you your own screening process to see if you are ready for CHE. Thank you.
Thanks.